You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us for the very, very first time, welcome aboard. I'm delighted you're here, and I think you will be too. And I hope you make a habit out of it. It's a great habit to get into. Lots of folks around this planet have that habit. And I hope you get it too. If you just got to be addicted to something, be addicted to this show. Tonight is K-Files night. That means that immediately after the show tonight, I begin sending out our free weekly newsletter. And when we say free, it's not like a lot of the stuff you see on the internet where they say, you get this for free. And then you go over there to get it, and, well, you get it for free if you do this, if you do that. You got to fill out a survey and all that stuff. No, we speak English here, and so when we say it's free, it's free. And all you have to do is go to my website, click on where it says K-Files e-zine, you'll see it in red letters, and subscribe. That's it, and then you're in, you start getting the K-Files e-zine. You can unsubscribe anytime you want, by the way. And so there's no strings attached. It's a good deal. And it'll keep you up to date on what's happening inside the show. And keep you up to date on what has been happening, what is happening, and what we think will be happening in the near future. Also, lots of links to lots of other sites and articles and things, and videos that I think you'll find quite interesting. Speaking of quite interesting, how about the topic of Roswell? Now, look, there are some people who have written to me and have said, in the past, that they're just tired of hearing about Roswell. And, okay, that's fine. But, look, it is probably the single most important UFO incident, UFO case, in American history. At least as far as we, the public, know. And there are a couple of guys who have been involved in investigating the Roswell incident for years, a couple of decades. And they have a new updated version of their book, Witness to Roswell. It looks like this. I read this the day this arrived. I read the entire thing in one sitting. I sat down and read the whole book. Absolutely fantastic. It's got, in addition to a whole lot of other things, it's got a whole bunch of deathbed confessions by people who had something to do with and knowledge of Roswell. The identity of the Boeing engineer that was called to examine the wreckage from this crash. Also, how about that nurse? Remember the nurse that nobody could find? Well, we're going to find out tonight whether these guys found and identified that nurse, and what did they find out if they did do that. My guest is Thomas Carey. He is co-author along with Donald Schmidt, and Thomas Carey will join us here in just a moment to discuss this amazingly detailed book about a very amazing UFO incident. When we come back from this break, Thomas Carey will be with us. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest tonight, as I said, is Tom Carey. And Tom, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Kevin. So good to be with you.
Tom, I told you in a private conversation on the telephone that this is one of the most amazing books. It's the best documented that I have seen on Roswell. And I've been talking about this book from the day I got it, and some of the people in the audience have already in previous shows called in and said, "Hey, you know, I got that book, Witness to Roswell," and wow! So we're already pretty much acquainted with you and the book just from my talking about it on previous shows. But let me tell folks a little bit about you. You're a native of Philadelphia, and you hold degrees from Temple University and California State University, Sacramento. And you also attended the University of Toronto in its PhD program in anthropology. You're an Air Force veteran. You've been active for years with various organizations that investigate reports of UFOs. For instance, MUFON, you were the state section director for southeastern Pennsylvania from 86 until 2002. You were a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies from 91 until 2001. You were a member of CUFO's Board of Directors from 1997 until 2001, and you've just been involved in UFO investigation, I would say up to your eyes, for a long period in your life, and I think folks will recognize you as well, you know, visually, because they've seen you on Larry King Live. You've been on CNB, Friends Saturday. You've been on Coast to Coast, so they've heard you. You're just out there. You are really into UFO investigation. Now, you're a successful businessman, retired businessman. How does a successful businessman get this interested and this involved in UFO investigation? What is it that triggered that for you?
Well, Kevin, I think like most of us, I was struck by the phenomenon of UFOs when I was a kid. I just thought it was a fascinating subject. My older brother introduced it to me, and I just thought, wow, what is this? And, of course, I read all of the books, from Donald Kehoe to Frank Edwards to, Timothy Good, you name it. I've read them. And at some point, I said to myself, I'd like to do more than just read about them. And that's when I joined MUFON and conducted on-site investigations locally here in southeastern Pennsylvania. But when I read the first Roswell book, Roswell Incident 1980, I was hooked on the so-called crashed saucer phenomenon, as to the exclusion of, you know, the rest of the phenomenon. Lights in the sky, close encounter cases, abductions, crop circles, even the dead animals when they dissect them. I forget what they call that.
The mutilations.
Mutilations, yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are all sort of under the umbrella of UFOs. But for me, and I think, you know, most people are interested in one aspect of the phenomenon to the general exclusion of the others. Mine happens to be the nuts and bolts UFO cases. As you said in your opening, the most famous UFO case probably of all time, certainly the one that's known around the world, is the Roswell case. Now, I didn't become interested in it because it was the best known. I just found it to be the most interesting case I'd ever come across. You have a crashed UFO. You have a crew that was came along with it. Dead bodies. One was alive. You have a government cover up. You have death threats. You have people coming forward 30 years after the event. We're racing the Undertaker. It's just, for me, it's the most exciting long-term proposition that I've been involved in. And I was involved in sports in my youth, and I, you know, have had some moments in sports. But for a long-term excitement and interest, when I filled out that high school questionnaire and what you want to do when you grow up, I didn't fill out UFO investigator, but it's something that just came along, and like the Roswell crash, I've been on it now. The Roswell case alone, I haven't investigated any other cases in the last 18 years. I've been solely on the Roswell case, and I'm as interested today as we speak as when I first became active in its investigation in 1991.
I think we already know the answer to this question, but it's incumbent upon me to ask it. From your point of view, after 18 years of in-depth investigation of the Roswell case, is there any doubt in your mind as to whether a true unidentified flying object crashed at Roswell?
Well, no one is entirely, you know, nothing in life is certain except death and taxes. But I'm 99.9999% sure that a UFO crashed, one of their 1947 models, outside of Roswell during the first week of July 1947. It carried a crew of between 4 and 7 occupants, and one was alive and was recovered alive. That I'm 99.999% sure of. We've eliminated all other possibilities. And even the Air Force, in its investigation, did us a favor and they confirmed our investigation that that there was nothing else involved. Where we differ is that we believe it was a UFO and the Air Force believes it was a balloon. But the Air Force did us a favor in affirming that it was no such thing as a experimental fighter aircraft or a Japanese balloon bomb or an errant atomic bomb or a V-2 rocket, which they were testing in those days. The Air Force eliminated those as well. So it comes down to the bottom line is, was it a UFO or was it a balloon or a balloon array in their Project Mogul? And Project Mogul sounds, you know, good and plausible to the uninformed, but once you look at the case possibly being this high altitude balloon contraption, it falls apart like a cheap suit. So there's no doubt in my mind as to what happened back in 1947.
Well, let's talk about balloons and Mogul for just a moment. Balloons in general. Now, I have, maybe I'm all wet on this, and if I am, you tell me, but I have said that Major Jesse Marcel was the air intelligence officer for the 509th Wing, which was the only atomic-armed wing of any Air Force on the planet at the time. And whenever they released the information, the press, famous press release, that the Army had recovered a flying disc, and then within hours, you have General Ramey hosting some reporters in his outer office, and Jesse Marcel is there, and you see the photographs of him with kind of a sheepish look on his face.
The funny little look on his face.
Yeah, and he's holding up these shreds of a weather balloon, and they give the press this story that, hey, you know, it was misidentification. Now, here's what I've said. I've observed, first of all, this is the top air officer the Air Force has. And he doesn't understand what a weather balloon looks like? That's inconceivable. What's also interesting to me is that none of those reporters asked that question. None of those reporters said, hang on a minute here. How is it, Marcel, that you, the air intelligence officer for the atomic armed wing on the planet, cannot identify a weather balloon? None of them asked that question. And it seems to me that right at that point, the whole story about it being a weather balloon falls apart.
Well, you're absolutely right in your statement and your conclusions. Jesse Marcel was the intelligence officer for our most elite military unit at the time. It was the only atomic bomb group, the only atomic group in the world of any army or air force or nation. And on top of that, Marcel had taken weather classes, classes that he would have become familiar with every type of balloon out there. Now, we're talking, whether we're talking the weather balloon or the Project Mogul balloon, we're still talking about the same type of balloon, a rubber neoprene balloon hoisting a tinfoil radar kite made out of tinfoil like you would see in a Hershey bar or spearmint chewing gum wrapper. It was reinforced by glue and balsa wood. These are any items that not only would Marcel have become familiar with, but any six-year-old. So to believe the Air Force version of this, you have to assume that not only Jesse Marcel, but everybody down the chain of command at the 509th Bomb Group in Roswell were dopes, and their fingers were on the atomic bomb. That's what you have to conclude.
It's just inconceivable.
It's inconceivable. Now, the counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cavett, who the Air Force relied on in their 1994 report, Fact Versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert, where they put forth this Project Mogul high-altitude balloon array as their official explanation for the Roswell wreckage. Cavett, who is on record as lying to us several times, first he said he wasn't at Roswell, then he said he wasn't involved, and then he said he went out there with Marcel, and it was clear to him that it was just a balloon. Now, if Sheridan Cavett, who is one of the chief Air Force witnesses, recognized it as a balloon, why did he not tell Colonel Blanchard or General Ramey that because they dispatched many, many troops out to the site and equipment to clean up the site, which cost the government lots and lots of money. So why did he just speak up and say it was a balloon, General? You don't have to send anything out there, because he had it all tucked under his arm when he came back. So that's a non sequitur there. It just doesn't follow. You know, he said something. And you know, to prevent all of that deployment of heavy equipment.
Well, let me ask you this about, I mean, you know, there are people that still ask, do you think there is a government cover-up? And I've said many times, of course there is. That's, you know, we're paying them, essentially, to not tell us things. And, I mean, because of the regulations they operate under. But it didn't used to be that way. It seems that it started at Roswell, maybe a little before that, but it seems that Roswell is where it really kicked off this whole cover-up thing. In all of your research, have you come up with at least a theory as to why? Why all of a sudden did this have to go into the darkness?
Well, of course we're speculating because they haven't told us. But the most plausible explanation is several-fold. When this happened, the Air Force at Roswell first thought it was a Russian device because of the funny writing on it. You know, they had these symbols that they couldn't decipher. They thought, oh, it might be Russian. Then they realized that it wasn't Russian. And, of course, the Cold War was starting in 1947. The Cold War actually started in 1946 with the dropping of the Iron Curtain across Eastern Europe. Now, it was clear that the Soviet Union was our potential enemy. And here we had in our hands an advanced device whose secrets, if we could crack them, would reveal who knows what as far as advanced in technology. So it's something we would want to keep from a potential enemy. And you know yourself the old saying, if you want to keep something from your enemies, you also have to keep it from your friends.
Well, that's true.
So that's how it started. Also with the impetus of, let's see, 1938 was 9 years prior to 1947 when they had the famous War of the Worlds radio episode on Mercury Radio Theater. Starring Orson Welles. It was a radio adaptation of the famous H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds story. Even though the sponsors and the announcers stated up front that it was a play, it was just a play, there was panic on the East Coast. The entire East Coast of the United States went into a panic. So that was still fresh in their minds. If they announced such a discovery, would there be another panic? Would there be a collapse of our monetary and social institutions, perhaps religious institutions, things like that? Sort of where we are today. Oh, that's a joke.
Yeah, got it. We have to step away a few minutes for a break. We'll be back on the other side of this break and continue talking about why the cover-up. Don't go away, folks. More with Tom Carey. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Tom Carey, co-author of Witness to Roswell. And let me say, as I hold up the book, let me say, if you don't have this book, you need to get this book. You need to read it. It is amazing. Now, Tom, you were in the middle of explaining the reasons the cover-up began, and the break interrupted us. So the mic is yours, sir.
So there were logical reasons for the cover-up initiation back in 1947, and I'm anticipating the second part of your question is why is there still a cover-up?
You are correct.
And again, we're speculating on cover-ups in general. Is that it could be a cover-up of ignorance? That's always a possibility with politicians and the government. I know that we learned from two officers who were stationed at Roswell back in 47, retired General Woodrow Woody Swancutt and the base adjutant, Major Patrick Saunders. Both of them said essentially the same thing to us independently, that at first they thought it was a Russian device, and they realized it wasn't. And then they both said something very ominous. He said that they both said, we didn't know what their intentions were, meaning them. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what their intentions were. So when you're given those sorts of circumstances, you're not going to go public with something that you don't understand, and to admit that would be that you're, especially for the Air Force, that whose mission it is to control the skies, you're admitting that you're not in control of your skies. So there, the military mind is not prepared to admit something like that, that they're failing in their mission. But as far as the cover-up today, cover-ups, if something has always been covered up, and now we're talking about 62 years of cover-up with Roswell, if something's always been covered up, it tends to get a life of its own. And the cover-up will just go on ad infinitum from administration to administration. And it's something that no one is prepared to challenge, because if you're in the military, say you're in the Air Force and you want a career in the Air Force and you're a young officer, you're not going to go up to your commanding officer and say, "Hey, General, how about that Roswell incident? What do you think that's going to do for your career?"
It will do something. Absolutely, it will end it.
Certainly. Certainly, and it has happened. So in the military, you learn to keep your mouth shut. That's one of the things you learn. And so there's probably nobody asking. Certainly politicians who are not profiles in courage, as we know. No senator is going to admit an interest in UFOs. No congressman is going to admit an interest in UFOs. Even Congressman Stephen Schiff, who initiated the Government Accounting Office investigation of Roswell in 1993, he felt compelled to state that he was not trying to investigate the case. He was only doing it to see if documents relating to the Roswell incident had been properly handled and classified. He professed no interest, even though he was from New Mexico. He professed no interest in the Roswell case itself as to whether it was true or not. So he felt he had to say that. No politician wants to be known as, "Oh, there goes Senator UFO." That would be curtains for his or her career.
So, I made this observation, I think it was last night. If not, it was the night before. And that is, these politicians, it was last night, these politicians are afraid of the very monster they helped to create. And that is this government plan, and we now know from documents that the use of ridicule and discrediting people was part of a government plan to control the UFO information. That's now known from documents acquired in Freedom of Information request. Now, they created that monster. They've been so good so effective at using ridicule and discrediting people that they now fear the monster they created. And although it was perhaps not them personally, it was other politicians, other generals, other military officers that instituted all of this, it's still, it's their baby to rock, and the baby has grown up to be a monster. And they fear the ridicule and the damage
ridicule
it would do.
Ridicule is still an effective device. And
well, it is for people who care, really, you know, what the public thinks about them. And a politician certainly has to care.
Most professional people, I'm talking now about doctors, lawyers, scientists, politicians. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out.
Successful businessmen like yourself.
Yes, most professionals, the subject of UFOs is not something to that you want known, if you're interested in. It's not something that's going to advance your career. Even today, 62 years after the modern age of UFOs began, it's still a subject. Well, you know yourself, most people that you know have either seen a UFO or knows someone that has seen one.
That's true.
But yet you bring up the subject to a professional person, and I've done this, their face turns white, and they walk away from you. I've had that happen to me. It's like I stabbed them in the heart with a stake, and they just don't want the subject to be near them because it's a bad career. It's a bad career device. So better not to let it be known. You know that you're even interested, even mildly, in the subject.
Now, you ran into this with a number of the people that you interviewed and or attempted to interview. And one of those is the nurse that I think, and I could be wrong about this because I can't keep it all straight in my head like you can because you've been studying this and investigating it for 18 years. But I think we heard about this nurse from the mortician in Roswell, Glenn Dennis.
You're right.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
Now, she's the one that I believe he said she ordered the baby caskets, the small caskets.
We don't know that she's the one that did that.
Okay. What was his connection with her? How did I'm a little fuzzy on how he came into contact with her.
The Glenn Dennis story, and I have to state up front, Kevin, that most of what we're talking about tonight, most everything in this case, the individual witnesses, these are things that we've been developing for years. Some of the witnesses, it's taken 10 years to work with them to get them to talk. So everything has a long history to it. The Glenn Dennis story, he's the mortician from Roswell. He's still alive, in frail health, however. He's the his story, I guess, came out, he went public in the early 90s with it. That when the, what was that show, the Unsolved Mysteries show with Robert Stack.
Uh-huh.
He was interviewed on that show in either 1990 or 91, and he talked about getting phone calls in the afternoon from the base.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to know if they had child-sized caskets. And he said, well, we have one in stock, and we can get some more by tomorrow. Should I do it? And they said, hold off. And then he received more telephone calls throughout the day asking about how to preserve tissue that had been laying out in the desert for some time. And finally he said, look, have you had an accident? I'll come right over and help you out. And they said, oh, no, this is for future use. So he thought, you know, he hung up the phone. He says, "Well, I guess that's that." Well, later in the day, the Ballard Funeral Home for whom he worked also had the contract for the airbase south of Roswell for ambulance service. Now, if you can imagine this, a hearse doubling as an ambulance. Now, I don't want to, if I'm hurt, I don't want to go to the hospital in a hearse, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So he took an injured airman, had been, he said, was injured in a motorcycle accident. So he drove him to the hospital. Now, this is late in the afternoon, early evening of that same day, and he noticed, he drops the airman off at the emergency room. He noticed all this activity going on. And a lot of doctors and medical people he did not recognize. He knew most of the doctors and nurses there. He was very friendly with one nurse, a nurse named Eileen Fanton, whose picture's in the base yearbook. And we've interviewed other airmen who were stationed there that confirmed that Glenn and this nurse had been seen quite often together whenever he came on to the base. So he went into the hospital, and he gets stops to get a Coca-Cola, and he says, "What's going on here?" And an officer comes up to him and says, "Who are you?" And he says, "Well, I'm Glenn Dennis. I'm the ambulance driver. I work for Ballard's." And they say, "Just a minute." And in that interim, he sees his nurse friend Eileen Fanton coming out of a side room there, holding a towel over her face, coughing, and she sees Glenn and tells him to get out of there quick. That he'll get in trouble if he's caught in there, and he doesn't know what's going on. And just then, major comes up to him, captain or major, I forget which rank, and he says, "Now listen here, bub, you don't see anything going on here. Nothing happened here. There's been no crash, and you're not supposed to be here." And he orders two fellas to physically remove him from the hospital, which they do. And they hustle him out to his hearse, and they order him to drive off the base and back to Ballard's funeral home. And they follow him all the way just to make sure. Well, next day, he meets up with his nurse friend at the officers' club. And it's there that she tells him that she had taken part in an aborted autopsy of these little creatures. I forget the term she used. It wasn't aliens. It could have been creatures. It could have been something else, but it wasn't like we use the term today, aliens. But she drew them for Dennis on a prescription pad, and they were the typical 3.5 foot tall alien that we know today, with the big head and the slanted eyes and no nose, no ears, and just a little slit for mouth. And so she's not feeling good anyway. And so she leaves, and she says, I'll talk to you later." And he's there sitting there in the officers' club, stunned about what he had been told.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll continue with this story when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking this evening with Tom Carey, and he is a co-author of a book called Witness to Roswell. You got to get it. It really is a super book. Just before we bring him back on the line, let me remind everyone that is a member of our members area that tomorrow night is the first Saturday night of the month. That means I'll be in the chat room. And I'm looking forward to seeing you there as well, all right? So just go to the chat room at the same time you normally tune in for the show, and I'll be there. All right, Tom, we were in the midst of this Glenn Dennis story, and the nurse has drawn a sketch of what these things look like. And then what happened next?
Yes, I think we left them. She had just left the officer's club with Glenn Dennis sitting there with a stunned look on his face, looking at this prescription pad with the drawing of the alien. She was sick, so she went back to the nurse's quarters, and Glenn went back to Ballard's. Well, a day or two later, he tried to get in touch with the nurse, only to be told that she had been transferred, and that she would be in touch with him. And so, I guess a couple weeks went by, month or two, and he received a letter from her over in Great Britain. She had been transferred to a unit over in England. And so they exchanged, I think, one letter, and then the next letter that Dennis sent her came back with a stamp on it, undeliverable, deceased. And he was told that she was killed in a training exercise. A plane crashed. There were some nurses, and she was killed in a training exercise with the other nurses. And that's the official story. That's where Glenn Dennis left it. He would never tell anybody the nurse's name, and we could not get any more information out of him because he said he promised her that he would never reveal her name. Well, the civilian investigators picked up on the story, and we investigated the story as best we could for several years. And we came to the conclusion that there had been no plane crash, as Dennis said, and we could never find a nurse in military records with the name. Well, I'm sorry, he did give a name. The name was Naomi Maria Self. That was the name he gave for mm-hmm. the nurse. And no one could find a nurse of that name. So confronted with that information, Dennis says, "I gave you a phony name," and the silence was deafening. "I gave you a phony name. I promised I would never reveal it." And at that point, you have to dismiss his story because he got caught lying, right? In a court of law, he would be...
Yep, he's finished.
He'd be finished. But we... We continued on the Glenn Dennis story. Whenever we were in Roswell, we would ask other witnesses if his story was true. And we found a witness that back in 1947, he was a policeman, and he recalls Dennis telling him about the calls that day for the child caskets. He remembered it distinctly. And others remembered that he was friendly with a nurse that had the description of a young Audrey Hepburn, which is the description that Glenn gave us. And they even gave us her name. It was Eileen Fanton, and she's in the yearbook. So we looked up Fanton's record, and it turns out that she was transferred out of Roswell, not at the time of the incident, but maybe a month or two later, because of medical reasons, and she died young in the early 1950s of a medical condition. So, in many, many ways, this fit the description of his nurse. Now, the bottom line is, we believe that Eileen Fanton, which is the nurse that Glenn Dennis has used for this story of his, was a cover. She is not the nurse that we're looking for. That he must have heard the story or participated in it with another nurse. And we found a nurse a third party called us. Sometimes, you know, we get these phone calls. They call us or they call the museum. Of a woman called the museum and said that in the 1960s, she worked on the base with a woman who had been a nurse at the base back in 1947, quote-unquote, when the bodies came in. And she told this woman the story, and she said, yes, I was there. I was there when the bodies came in, and she described them. And she said, however, if you ever tell anybody, I will deny the story. Now, why would a woman call us out of the blue just to, you know, if she did not believe this story? And, you know, it's not something you would, why would you make up a story like that and call a UFO museum in Roswell? I mean, there's nothing that you're going to get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing was, this woman would not tell us the name of the nurse, the former nurse that she heard the story from. But her husband had let slip the fact that her husband, the former nurse's husband, was a golf pro at the New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell. So knowing that, it was easy for us to find out who that was and then who his wife was. And in fact, she turned out to be a former Army nurse. So the story is checking. So we decide, okay, we have a big one here. So we brought in Wendy Connors, who is a UFO historian for Project 1947, thinking that maybe a female would have a better rapport with this former nurse who was then, who is now in her 80s, would have a better rapport than either of us would. So we brought in Wendy when she was in Roswell, and we did a cold call. We drove Wendy to the house, and she went up and knocked on the door, and she spent 2 hours inside with the former nurse. And the nurse did deny the story, but the first words out of her mouth, according to Wendy, were, "Did Glenn Dennis tell you that?" Glenn Dennis tell you that? And she was not happy. But yet, even though she denied, she spent 2 hours with Wendy. And you know, Wendy being the historian, she got all the information she could from the woman, her history, and she had been an Army nurse. And according to her records, she came back to the States. She was discharged in 1946 because she married she was an officer, and she had married a enlisted man. So she had to leave the service. They settled in Roswell, and she had worked at the base in a civilian nurse capacity, you know, having nurse training.
Mm-hmm.
And so the very next day, Don and I, we go back to the museum. We're in Roswell, and we go back to the UFO museum, and we corner Glenn Dennis, and we said, hey, Glenn, we found the nurse. And he says, who are you talking about? I said, well, let me, I'm not going to give you her name. Let me give you her first name. And I started to pronounce the woman's name is Mary Lowe. I started to say, he said, Mary Lowe? I said, yes. He said, yeah, she knows all about it. And this is a name we had known Glenn for over 10 years. He had never mentioned her, never. And he says, yeah, she knows all about it. And this is after the blood returned to his face because you know, when he said that, you know, the blood left his face, and he started talking real fast. And he wouldn't tell us any more about her other than, yeah, she knows all about it. So the next day, we're in the museum, and in comes Glenn Dennis, and he says, boys, I got to talk to you. And he had a look on his face like he had been taken to the woodshed. And he says, you know that we were talking about yesterday about Mary Lowe. Forget that. She doesn't know anything about it. So it wasn't, it didn't take too much imagination to think that he had received a call from Mary Lowe.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. I've got a question about this obvious fear that all these witnesses still have when we come back on the other side of this break. And then we'll open up the telephone lines for you folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We will open up the telephone line so that you can call in with your questions or comments in just a moment. But right now, I have a question for our guest, Tom Carey. Tom, in everything you've described there's sort of a common theme in what you've described, and that is that these witnesses, right up till today, seem to be very afraid of something. What's the deal with that?
The thing that they fear, certainly ridicule. They also fear attention. They don't want attention, and especially if they're living on a government pension, they don't want anything to interfere or affect their government pension. Those are the big things.
Have they been threatened that they'll lose their government pension?
Some have. Others have not been threatened, but they're playing it safe. They like it the way things are. They don't want anything to cause any ripples. They know this is a famous case. They know the government has stated one thing, and that it's a balloon. So they don't want to do anything to cause any ripples. No matter what you say, that we are unaware of any instance where a person has been their pension has been affected. There's even been an amnesty declared for former military who have information pertaining to Roswell, who believe that they might be covered by some sort of security oath. There's an amnesty in effect for that. But
yeah, I read that in your book. That came out. That came from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, didn't it?
No, it came from Secretary of the Air Force Sheila Widnall in 1994, when the Air Force did their own study at the behest of the Government Accounting Office. Sheila Widnall declared a proclamation to absolve or remove any security oaths that the military witnesses thought they might be subjected to in order to foster a free exchange of information. So I bring this up to them, but it doesn't do any good in most cases, because they're locked in to, well, I have a government pension, I am not going to take any chances, so they don't say anything. Those are the major factors.
Mm.
Plus, they don't want the attention. They're in their 80s now, and they just don't want the attention.
Well, I guess even if you mention the names of, like, generals and other high-ranking officers that have talked, that doesn't budge them, huh?
Correct. It's that they don't want to take any chances. If I could finish the Glenn Dennis story just quickly.
Sure.
Where things stand today is that we believe that the nurse that Glenn Dennis was talking about is a cover story, that the real nurse was this Mary Lowe, who was there when the bodies came in, and as she told of a fellow worker in the 1960s, they were working in a civilian capacity, that she was there. She knows Glenn Dennis. Glenn Dennis knows her. So whether Glenn actually went to the hospital, we don't know, or whether he just got the information from Mary Lowe and made up the story, we don't know. There's one addendum to this, Kevin. Last year, we received information about a woman in a nursing home in Albuquerque who had some information about the nurse. So I called her. And her story is that in 1947, she was stationed, she was working in Washington, D.C. in a civilian capacity. And a group of girls, they used to get together for dinner about once a month. And late 47, they got together for dinner, and one of the regular attendees had brought a girlfriend along with her who was an Army nurse. And They got to talking over dinner, and the woman relayed that she had been at Roswell, which their eyes and ears perked up at that point. They said, "Oh, were you involved in that goings-on back there in July?" And she said, "Oh, yes. I was the nurse that ordered the caskets, the little caskets." And this woman had been transferred out shortly thereafter to Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. That's where she was transferred. It's so long ago, the woman in the nursing home doesn't remember her name, but she has no reason to make up a story like that.
All right. I want to open up the telephone lines, and let me explain for all of our new listeners how this works. The telephone number for Canada and the USA is 602-539-9580. Now, that will work from anywhere in the world. If you call me from anywhere, that works, okay? But we realize that some of you would have to make a international long-distance call if you're calling from somewhere other than Canada or the USA. So if you're outside of the USA and Canada, you can use our flash message feature on my website. Now, the way you do that, go to my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com, and scroll down. You'll see a link that says flash message. All right, just click that link, and you can send a flash message to me. All right, I'll get it. We call it a flash message because when you send it, I get a notice flashing on my screen over here. All right, so let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington State.
Yeah, Ryan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hello, how are you?
I'd like to say I really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
I think one of the things I really enjoy about your work is that you stick to the nuts and bolts, which is something that I really like, and you don't jump ahead to try and determine who they are, where they're from, and all that, which is...
We leave that to others.
Yeah, people do that a little too often when we're just trying to get the case down. But the question I had, has there ever been any incidences of witnesses that told you stories of any abduction stories, like right around that time, possibly, or any of the witnesses that have you heard of any kind of alien abduction?
Not at that time. Quite honestly, the witnesses that we talked to are either witnesses that we have located on our own, usually military that were stationed at the base, or someone that has called the UFO Museum in Roswell with a bit of information about the case. And occasionally some of them will talk about sightings, the UFO sightings that they've had. And whenever I do get a witness that goes off into the abduction, you know, they'll mention an abduction-type scenario of a friend or something. Usually it's not the person that's calling, it's somebody else. I direct them to one or more of the abduction investigators, but we do not get into abduction or any of the other stuff. We're really focused on the nuts and bolts of this case. And we leave, as you said earlier, speculation as to where they're from or why they're here and why did they crash. Although we do have our opinion as to why the craft crashed, but why they're here or where they're from, we never get into.
All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin. You're going to have to speak up and directly into your telephone.
Hello there. Hello there, Mr. Carey. Can you hear me? Can you hear me at all?
Very well.
Oh, you can hear me very well. Okay, good. Kevin's having problems on his end.
No, I turned the volume up.
Oh, you turned the volume up. Okay.
Yeah, I've got you cranked so high.
I recognize that Ontario accent.
Well, you're recognizing the northern Ontario accent, where we actually
yes.
had our own Roswell up in northern Ontario back in 1954. But I got to say, you know what? I heard earlier in the show that people are quote-unquote tired of hearing Roswell. You know what? I'm never tired of hearing of Roswell. I love hearing about it. I love reading about it. For the simple reason why is that, you know, apart from the 1942 Battle of Los Angeles and others, the Roswell crash gave us at least the first glimpse in this modern era that we are not alone. You know, it was the first incident that gave us proof that we are not alone in this galaxy, and that's why I love hearing about Roswell. I love hearing
exactly
every theory that we have about Roswell, that we are definitely not alone. Whether it was the Greys that crashed at Roswell, whether it was Anunnaki, whether it was whatever, we are definitely not alone. And no matter what the different theories come out about Roswell, the main gist of the stories is that there was a crash that happened at Roswell. There were beings other from this earth that were at Roswell, and I think that's the most important part of that story.
So that's the promise of Roswell, where many of your other cases, most of your others, it's a light in the sky, it's a stain on a cornfield of oil or something. But Roswell, the promise at the end of the rainbow is a physical craft and physical beings that were not from this earth. That's the promise, and that's our mandate, is to find out once and for all if this is true. And we certainly believe that it is.
All right, let's talk about the 4 to 7 occupants. We hear from some investigators that there were no occupants. We hear from others that there were. We hear that there were 2 crash sites. So what's the deal with this? How do we get to the point where we conclude that there were occupants?
Well, there were eyewitnesses, a number of eyewitnesses all describing the same thing. We believe there were 2 sets of bodies, Kevin. The bodies that Glenn Dennis was involved with was one set. And those bodies, as we know from Glenn and others, stunk to high heaven. They had been out in the desert longer than the first set. The first set was found just north of town with the remains of the ship. The ship blew up over Mac Brazel's sheep pasture near Corona and rained down all this small pieces of debris. Now, in that explosion, which we think was caused by a lightning strike, 2 to 3 bodies were jettisoned. When the ship blew up, they just flew out with the explosion and landed not far from that sheep pasture, maybe 2.5 miles east. And they met their demise, and they lay out in the desert for a few days. The rest of the ship, or the inner cabin, and this is speculation now, the inner cabin remained intact and stayed airborne for another 30 miles, coming to rest just north of the town of Roswell. In that remaining portion of the ship, we believe that there were 4 beings. 3 were dead, and 1 was still alive when civilians arrived at the crash site the next day. And so that's why we say there were between 4 and 7. 4 at the one site, with 1 being alive, and then 3 at the second site. up near Corona. So they were removed to the base. First, they went to the hangar, the main hangar, P3 or Building 84, as it's now called, and then to the base hospital, where doctors from all over the country came to visit. And perhaps Glenn Dennis ran in on that and saw what was going on. But we do have a number of witnesses out in the field in the recovery, some that even accompanied the ship and the bodies back to the base, and others who were at the base hospital, all reporting these creatures that were 3.5 to 4 feet tall, perhaps 35 to 40 pounds, very frail body, but the overwhelming feature that has haunted most of them for the rest of their lives was the large head. Looked like a large inverted pear on the top of this frail little body, with slanted eyes, two little holes in the front for where the nose would be, two holes into the side of the head where the ears would be, and about an inch wide slit for a mouth that never went anywhere. And one of the witnesses even recalled that the one that was alive talked to him in his head. He was a fireman for the Roswell Fire Company, and he got out there and he saw this one that was walking around. And when he got home and told his family about it, they said, Daddy, did it talk? Did it say anything to you? And he said, yes, it talked to me, but it talked to me in my head, and it told me, don't worry about me. But there's nothing anybody can do. I accept my fate. There's nothing you can do, and I accept it. My comrades are dead, and so don't worry about me. So that's mostly what we got from him. But I thought that's quite remarkable.
Yeah, it is. All right, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. All right, we cannot hear anything from that caller, so let's take this other call. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kevin. This is Gary from New York.
Hi, Gary.
Good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
Quite ironic. Kevin and I earlier in the week just had a brief discussion about Major Marcel, and I have to reiterate, you know, I just can't wrap my mind around how Major Jesse Marcel could mistake balsa wood and tin foil. I think the government has just disgraced this man terribly. And what's your opinion on that?
You're absolutely right. He was the fall guy. General Ramey used him as a photo prop. And to think about it, to accuse your chief intelligence officer of your bomb group that's charged with delivering the atomic bomb with not being able to identify a pile of balsa wood, rubber, and tinfoil, to be unable to distinguish that from a spaceship is quite an indictment. Now, the indictment would also carry to his commanding officer, Colonel William Blanchard. However, Blanchard went on to gain 4 stars, become a lieutenant general and vice chief of the Air Force. He was next in line to be the Air Force chief of staff, but he died at his desk at age 50 in the Pentagon in 1966. So, yes, Jesse Marcel was the fall guy. And perhaps that's the reason he got out of the Air Force a few years, well, a year or two after that, rather than you know, to make it a career. So to accept the Air Force story, you just have to assume that the fellas at the 509th Bomb Group were all dopes, and it just is an insult to the intelligence.
It exactly is an insult, and I wish that Major Marcel could be exonerated. I just refuse to believe this man, well-trained, well-schooled.
You know, and everybody that I've interviewed, and I've asked about Jesse Marcel, they all said he was a straight arrow. All military, just a straight arrow, never not given to flights of fancy, and everybody had the utmost respect for him.
Yeah. All right, Gary, I thank you for your call, and I am in full agreement with you about your opinion about Jesse Marcel. I mean, as I stated, Tom, earlier, for me, any story about Roswell, any of the cover stories that came out, fall apart right there. They fall apart right when they make Jesse Marcel the fall guy in that meeting with the press. At that point, it's inconceivable.
You know, Kevin, that if the Air Force had been smarter and said that what had crashed was an experimental jet fighter plane, super secret experimental jet fighter plane, we wouldn't be here tonight talking about it. That would have been something that would have been believed. But they came up with this cockamamie weather balloon story that just insults everybody's intelligence, and so here we are.
Yeah, and I say often, look, we understand. Even we may not agree sometimes, but we understand when the military needs to use a cover story. We understand that. That's part of the business. We understand that. But for God's sake, get better script writers. tell us something that's at least plausible.
That was so far-fetched that, how about the... And they follow that up with the dummies from the sky explanation in 1997, the dime store mannequins, that to explain the bodies, and even the press was laughing at that. Even the press that were at the news conference in 1997 were laughing at the dummies from the sky.
Oh yeah, and of course, dropping those mannequins didn't happen until years after the Roswell thing.
10 years after.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Mark from Ohio.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to ask Tom if he had ever heard of the book called Alien Interview by Lawrence R. Spencer.
Yes, I have.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I called Lawrence when that book came out. I said, is this true or fiction? And he said it was fiction.
Really?
So, yes.
That's fascinating.
Because the way I figure it, if we haven't heard about it, if we haven't heard about it, we have to look at it very closely, because we've been on this case for a combined 40 years between the two of us. And when he came out with that book, and I'm looking at this cover and the picture of the nurse, and the nurse's name I do not recognize as a nurse being at Roswell. So I called him up. I said, look, do you really have something here, or what's the story? Is it true or fiction? And he said, it's fiction. So I said, thank you, sir.
So I guess you never read it.
Well, I have it, but I haven't gotten around to it yet.
All right, we have to take a break. And on the other side of this break, we'll continue with Tom Carey and your telephone calls. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Tom Carey. He is a co-author of what I think is a most phenomenal book. It is called Witness to Roswell. Now, everybody's got their own taste. I understand that. And some of you may read this book and say, oh, well, I already knew all that stuff, but I bet you don't. I bet when you read this book and see the documentation that's in here, you're going to be as impressed as I was. And I really, really mean that this stuff is well written and well documented. And you know, there's footnotes and the bibliography, and you know, it's this is a good book and well worth the small investment it takes to get it. The telephone number is 602-539-9580, 602-539-9580 for Canada and the USA. Please use that telephone number. If you're outside of the USA and Canada, you can call that number. It will work. Or you can use our flash message feature. Now, I've gotten three flash messages so far. One from Canada, which we don't put on the air, because you have a telephone number. And then two that really didn't have anything to do with tonight's show, but thank you for sending the flash messages. But to use the flash message feature, you go to my website and scroll down. You will see under Tom's picture, you will see a link that says flash message. Click it, and you can send your message then to me. And I will, provided that it's relative to the show, I'll read it and we'll ask Tom to comment on it. Tom, you guys have been involved, as you said, collectively, about 40 years investigating this single incident, the Roswell crash. One of the things that is a big admission out of the Air Force, as far as I'm concerned, is they finally admitted that, well, they admitted quickly that there had been a crash of something, but then they said it was a weather balloon. But they finally admitted that after, I think it was about 50 years, that, well, we have been lying about it. It was not a weather balloon.
Correct.
That was a big admission. And then this Project Mogul thing, you know, none of the flights of Mogul match the date of this crash.
Correct. The what they did, the Mogul explanation was actually discovered by civilian researchers, not the Air Force. It's not that they knew all along that, oh, yes, it's we lied, we knew all along it was a Project Mogul. It was not the case. They apparently were as stumped as anybody because I'm talking about the current members of the Air Force, at least 10 years ago, looking for an explanation that would fly. And some civilians came up with this Project Mogul, and so the Air Force accepted that and said, okay, that's what it was. And they threw it out there, I'm sure, with a hope and a prayer to be followed by the dummies from the sky explanation and 2 years after that. But as you say, the dates don't work. First they thought it was Project Mogul launch number 9, which they said, okay, that's the one that landed in Mac Brazel's sheep pasture.
Mm-hmm.
But then they did some checking and found the dates didn't work on that one. And they said, oh, geez, we can't use that one. This is after they had already come out with it. So they found the next date earlier than the first week in July, which would make it a June 4th launch. That's the only other one that worked. The problem with the June 4th launch of Project Mogul balloons, and this is the explanation they're stuck with, is that we had access to the diary of one of the project leaders, a Dr. Albert Crary, and no relation. And his diary says that the June 4th launch was scrubbed. that there was a low cloud cover, and it wouldn't have been a good launch day. So they just let the rubber balloons go without any payload.
Mm.
So that's all it was. There's no tinfoil to stupefy Jesse Marcel.
Yeah.
Or the men at the Roswell Army Airfield. So
so that balloon doesn't fly.
That balloon does not fly. It does not fly.
Let's go back to the phones. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Okay. Waited all that time and then hung up on us. I don't understand that. But it's a free country. I guess you can do that. The telephone number is 602-539-9580, 602-539-9580. And we would love to hear from you if you have a question or a comment. Let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is John from Oklahoma.
Hi, John.
Tom.
Tom.
1997, I got Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, and was very impressed with it. Where would you put that story into the greater scheme of all this?
The 1997 Corso book, The Day After Roswell, is extremely well written. It's written by William Burns, who publishes UFO Magazine. Extremely well written. He's a lawyer, and he's got a doctorate in some, I don't know, English or something, I don't know. But there are certain facts in the book that he's got wrong. However, the story about Corso being involved in re-engineering of the Roswell wreckage, some of the items that came from the wreckage, Corso was apparently, at least he says, he was charged with trying to re-engineer that stuff. My mind is open on that. I have not closed the book on that, because with some of our latest revelations, one of which is in the book about a re-engineered item, my mind has to be open to that, because it looks like that the memory metal that we referred to for many years as the Holy Grail of Roswell, this is the material that you can wad up in your hand. It's been reported by many witnesses that it would resume its original shape over a flat surface without a crease, and you couldn't cut it or scratch it or anything. Apparently, we have re-engineered that. I was not aware of that until late last year, because I was going around saying we hadn't been able to produce that, and apparently we have. So,
do you have any idea what that was made of?
Yes,
the memory metal.
Yes, this is very interesting. The Air Force, they were able to determine that the memory metal was made out of nickel and titanium. So what they did is they farmed out, made a contract with Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, to try to develop, because what was required was pure titanium, and we didn't have any of that in 1947, so they charged Battelle with trying to develop pure titanium and a strain of nickel that would go with that to reproduce this memory metal. And by 1962-63, they had developed their first replication of memory metal. And
okay, I have one more quick question. When I was at the museum in 98, I purchased the James Ragsdale story video. What's your opinion about that?
Well, Jim Ragsdale was allegedly a witness out in the camping out the night that the ship crashed, came screaming overhead and crashed into the desert. Now, the story he originally told Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt tracked pretty close to the story that we know. But what happened was that businessman in Roswell who's no longer living he wanted to cash in on the Jim Ragsdale story and purchase the land where this thing crashed. But the ranch owner would not sell, so they had Jim Ragsdale change his story to another location, citing a crash site in the Boy Scout Mountain, which is in another direction. So Jim Ragsdale, we believe, was right on in his first account, which appears in the 1991 book, UFO Crash at Roswell. I'm sorry, the Truth at the UFO Crash at Roswell, the 1994 Randall and Schmidt book. But then he became co-opted by a real estate developer, changed the story and put out a video and a book, which unfortunately, in my opinion, is not correct.
All right, John, thanks so much for the call. The telephone number is 602-539-9580. And we have a moment or two here, a minute or two, before we go to our next break. So if you wish to call, now's the time. Tom, does anyone in the military today or in some part of the government today still have the Roswell debris and or the true story?
Well, somebody has it. we don't know who it is, and we don't expect them to come clean anytime soon.
Who would you think would have it? Do you think it's the Air Force, or who's got it?
Well, we believe that the military has it, and I'll tell you why, is because the first Secretary of the Air Force was Stuart Symington. 1948, and I get this from the son of an eyewitness. He calls in the Air Force liaison to the Secretary of Defense. And so Symington brings this fellow in. He was a general named Montgomery. And he says, come over here, General. And so Symington takes his arm and he sweeps it across his desk, knocks everything off, and says, General, pick that up. So the general bends, he picks up all that stuff, puts it back on the desk as best he can. Symington does it again, sweeps his arm across the desk. Pick that up, General. So he picks it up again. And so he's about to do it a third time, and the general says, Mr. Secretary, we can do this all day. I don't know what your point is. He says, General, you just remember who you're working for. Symington felt he was out of the loop on a number of things, one of them being the UFO phenomenon, and especially Roswell. So it's our belief that the Roswell wreckage and everything associated with it is under military control, maybe with tacit oversight by the NSA, National Security Agency. That's just speculation. I don't know that. It's just a judgment.
All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll open the phone lines for one or two final calls and more with Tom Keery. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Tom Keery. Well, we lost Tom. I don't know what happened. We'll see if we can reestablish contact with him. And we'll see what happens here.
The line went dead.
Well, we must have been saying things that someone didn't want us to say. But that is not entirely unheard of here. But anyway, in these last few moments, let me say to the folks that the telephone line is open, 602-539-9580 is the telephone number. If you wish to call, now's the time. And we've got time for one, maybe two calls, but we won't take calls once we get into the last 2 minutes. All right, Tom, you were saying you think the military's got it.
Yes, and you have a civilian politician compliment that's not asking. So it's a perfect compliment to one another. One has it, and the other's not interested.
Do you think? And I've talked about this possibility, discussed it with a lot of people. But do you think that maybe they have discovered something technologically about that crash debris that they see as a possible threat, and are possibly, maybe not a threat from extraterrestrials, but if that information, the technological information, were to get out around the world, it could be used to create a threat for us?
Well, that's always a, of course, that's speculation, but it's always a possibility that they've had it now 62 years, and I'm satisfied that they've developed some things from it. It's always possible that something sinister could be developed from it. Certainly, that's something to consider. There's certainly no evidence for it, but in trying to explain the cover-up and why everything is so secret, you have to think of things like that. So, yeah, it's a possibility.
All right. This also calls for speculation, but when I asked earlier about, well, why did this cover-up even start? Why, you know, and you described for us reasons why it started. Primarily, okay, it's not Russian, and we don't know what their intentions are. And they took into consideration a possible panic among the public and so forth. Do you think, understanding that whatever you say will be speculation, but do you think that disclosure at this point, if they were to come out and say, okay, folks, here's what happened at Roswell. An alien spacecraft crashed. Bodies were recovered, and the crash debris was recovered. And the reason we've been keeping it a secret is because we didn't really know what we had here. But we feel like that the time has come where we can tell you that it is, in fact, an alien spacecraft that crashed. Do you think that would create panic among the public today?
My own view is absolutely not. We are at a period where we're discovering, I think the number now is close to 400 extrasolar planets outside of our solar system. Some even are apparently a small number resemble Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And deep sea quests, wherever we go, we find life. And my own view is that life in the universe is the norm rather than the exception. So people already accept that there's other life in the universe. Even the skeptics, the UFO non-believers, people who think that we have not been visited, even they accept that there's other life in the universe. So for me, and I firmly believe this, there would be no panic in the streets. The religious institutions would not dissolve. The financial institutions, well, maybe they'll even get better. I don't know. But no, those early scenarios of panic will not, in my view, obtain if this is announced tomorrow. But the problem is there have been four official announcements regarding Roswell, and we think a fifth one is out there, fostered by the government or the military, and picked up by newsmen and people in official capacities to say that they're calling Roswell now a myth. They refer to the myth of Roswell. We think that's the origin of that is from the, if not the Air Force, by some government entity. So if the Air Force came out tomorrow with a with this, which would be its sixth explanation, who would believe them?
Well, they have a look, this is an observation, it's not a criticism, but they have a credibility problem anyway. No one buys the spin they put on UFO sightings anymore.
Well, the
people just laugh at it now.
The major media does. They don't believe the military about anything other than UFOs. And the reason the major media believes the Air Force the story, whatever they put out, they believe, is because they want to protect their credibility for reporting other stories, non-UFO stories. Because to subscribe to the UFO phenomenon by a major media, you're diminishing your credibility in their eyes. So they do believe the Air Force regarding UFOs. So
they tow the party line on that. They certainly
yes,
do.
Yes, and it's one of preserving one's own credibility. That's what I believe. Remember, I said there's no senator that wants to be known as Senator UFO or Congressman UFO. It's the same with the media. Oh, the New York Times, can you believe it? They actually believe in flying saucers, snicker, snicker. So there goes their credibility. So they're not about to do that.
Yeah. And it's a little amazing to me because you have an official U.S. government document that states they're real. It's called Project Blue Book. It gives you thousands of cases where they basically debunk them, but well over 1,000 cases that they listed as unknown. And those are the ones where they had the most information, the most details, and the most credible witnesses. And
right,
it's,
and the first official Air Force report, the estimate of the situation back in 1948, authored by Nathan Twining, concluded that the UFOs were real, or as they called them, flying saucers were real and not something illusory.
Yeah.
Not something that was an illusion. But it was batted back down by General Vandenberg. He was not about to accept that. And it had nothing, and I'm convinced it had nothing to do with the conclusions, but he couldn't accept his organization subscribing to it for to maintain its own credibility. So he batted it back down when he knew they were real.
What was the name of that report?
It was the Air Force. I believe it was called Estimate of the Situation. It was 1948. I think it was Project Sign.
That's it. Yeah. I've read excerpts from that report. Listen, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's been fascinating, and I want to encourage everyone to get your book. It's called Witness to Roswell. Folks, you got to get it. All right, now, if you'll stay on the line with me for just a moment, I want to talk with you for just a moment after I go off the air. Well, there you have it, folks. Another great week here at the Kevin Smith Show and another great show. And it's been a delight. Thank you to each of you who called in and those who sent flash messages. Thank you. See me tomorrow night in the members area, Saturday night. I'll be there in the chat room. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.